Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 349, titled The Destabilization of the FBI. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2002, and for those of you who might be convinced that I had flipped before, you're really going to think that I've basically lost my marbles when you hear this broadcast. Suffice it to say that in other programs, I've spoken about the destabilization of the United States. I've spoken about my belief that the United States is currently undergoing a destabilization both from without and from within, not unlike the destabilization of France that occurred prior to the Second World War. And while France was engaged in a foreign war against a hostile power, that being World War II, it was at the same time subverted from within. This is along the keeping of the scenario that I presented in, for the record, 344, 5, and 6, that basically this constituted a Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire scenario. If Adolf Hitler had been in the White House when Pearl Harbor was attacked, this is what you would be seeing. More about that in a minute. Before I get directly into the subject material, namely the destabilization of the FBI, and by the way, many of the articles and items that I'm talking about in this program will be articles or items that I have dealt with in past broadcasts. I ask your indulgence. They have not been grouped together and conceptualized as they are in this program. But again, this is a very complex state of affairs, and I would encourage people not to oversimplify the analysis of the September 11th events. Now, before I get into the destabilization of the FBI, I want to read an article that was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This is from the Morris County, New Jersey Daily Record of Thursday, February 7th of the year 2002. This article is an AP story, Dateline New York. Its headline, New Jersey Name Found on Taliban Document. It reads in part as follows. A list of apparent Taliban recruits found in an Afghanistan house includes the name of a New Jersey high school valedictorian who spoke with contempt about America as a teenager, the New York Times reported Wednesday. A Times reporter found the undated document in December in a house in Kabul that neighbors said had been used by pro-Taliban Pakistani militants. It lists the name, New Jersey address, and telephone number of Hiram Torres. Quote, he is 20 years old, unmarried, knows driving, unquote, the document said. Torres, a 1993 high school graduate, would be 27 today, indicating the document is 7 years old. Now we're going to listen to Torres's background. We've heard a lot about John Walker Lind, the much-ballyhooed American Taliban from Marin County. We've been told about how the permissive background of Marin County led to his becoming a Taliban, sort of the implication being that his parents were aging hippies and didn't spank him enough. Listen to the background of Hiram Torres, not only a high school valedictorian, but an individual who spent a month at Yale University. His background is a long way from the spin that we're being given about John Walker Lind, and we've not been hearing much about Hiram Torres. His background and his apparent factors of genesis, so to speak. Torres' unsmiling face stares from pages of Perth Amboy High School's 1992 and 1993 yearbooks and pictures of the German Club, German Honor Society, and cross-country track team, skipping down. Penny Borkowski, who was in most of Torres' high school classes and knew him from the German Club, said Torres would listen to Hitler's speeches in German and recite them in the school hallways. Quote, he went on about Jews, he went on about all minorities, Borkowski told the Associated Press on Wednesday, again quoting, they had to be all put in one place, there was no use for them, that kind of thing, unquote, skipping down. Torres was the high school valedictorian in 1993, but refused to give his speech, Borkowski remembers. Teachers told the Times that Torres refused to speak because officials insisted that they be allowed to approve the text in advance. I wonder what he was planning on saying, given his inclination to recite Hitler's speeches. Skipping down again, it would appear that Torres also was operating with an eye to the future, even in high school. Torres also refused to pose for his senior high school picture, friend Sasheen Timbadia told the newspaper, explaining that he, quote, wanted to keep a low profile in case something happened in the future, unquote. Interesting background for this other American Taliban, someone we haven't been hearing too much about. Now, to the subject material of this broadcast, a major focal point, namely the destabilization of the FBI. This is something that I've spoken about intermittently before, and specifically in For the Record 310, and also in the first broadcast that I did about the September 11th attacks. Actually, for the record, 325 and 326. I spoke about my view that not only elements of U.S. intelligence, but the FBI in particular, was being subverted from within by what was, in effect, a fifth column, at one level allied with the underground Reich, and at another level aligned with elements of the U.S. intelligence that whose main allegiance was not only to the Bush administration's past and present, but also to elements of the petroleum industry, those administrations and the underground Reich being in no way unconnected, though not necessarily coterminous. I can appreciate that this is a complicated concept, perhaps incomprehensible to most listeners. I ask their indulgence, and above all, I ask that they use other broadcasts that I've done about this subject and reference the website for Spitfire as well. I'm going to give you some websites to access later on in the discussion. We're going to take a look now at a book that we've used a number of times in the past in this series on September 11th. It's a book called Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. This book was co-authored, by Richard Labeyrière and translated by Martin Demers. It was originally published in French in 1999, a softcover English language edition published in the year 2000 and copyrighted by Algora Publishing, ALGORA, ISBN number 1-892941-06-6. Visit their website at www.algora.com. What we're going to look at now is discussion of a conflict that occurred between the FBI and elements of CIA. The author here uses CIA in a blanket sense, but I think one could more properly see in this context, given that this book was originally written in French, the Bush/petroleum faction of the CIA. We're going to begin with discussion of a Philippine connection not only to Osama bin Laden through his brother-in-law, something we looked at in For the Record 330. We're also going to take a look at a connection to the first World Trade Center attack, and we're going to take a look in turn at a conference that took place after the embassy bombings in Africa in August of 1998 that we've also looked at in connection with September 11th. More about that in a minute. Turning to Dollars for Terror, the second American connection is more serious, for it directly touches the family relations of Osama bin Laden. One of bin Laden's six wives is Philippine. Since 1991, bin Laden's brother-in-law, Mohammed Jamil Khalif, had overseen the management of the International Islamic Relief Organization, or IIRO, a non-governmental organization that acts as cover for the financing of the Muslim Philippine guerrillas on the island of Mindanao, particularly the terrorist group Abu Sayyaf. Confronted with armed violence on the part of the Islamists in the south of the archipelago, Manila expedited an expulsion order against the brother-in-law in 1994. He had to leave the country, and he managed to enter the United States with a visa that was delivered with help from the CIA. This affair, reminiscent of the visa that was obtained under similar conditions by the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, implicated in the World Trade Center attack, by the way, this book originally authored and published in 1999, was obviously before the World Trade Center was devastated on September 11th. Beginning again, this affair, reminiscent of the visa that was obtained under similar conditions by the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, implicated in the World Trade Center attack, had already caused a crisis between the FBI and the CIA. The CIA had not been able to justify its willingness to support a Filipino suspected of financing terrorist organizations. On August 30, 1998, the Counterterrorism and Security International Journal organized a roundtable bringing together several anti-terrorist experts, including the former federal prosecutor Anders McCarty, Patrick Eddington, private consultant and CIA agent for 9 years, and Edward Bellotto, president of International Association of Counterterrorism and Professional Security, unquote. The discussion makes it clear that the FBI and the CIA had engaged in, quote, a war between the police forces, unquote, since the Gulf War, with the FBI reproaching the intelligence agency for its, quote, too great leniency with regard to its Islamist partners, unquote. To keep the situation from degenerating, the CIA requested that bin Laden's brother-in-law leave the United States in December of 1994. We've seen conflicts between elements of CIA and elements of the FBI in the past. Drug trafficking, the Iran-Contra scandal being one of the points of disagreement and divergence. In this context, one doesn't want to oversimplify the intelligence system in the United States. It's much larger than the CIA, and even the CIA itself has many different factions, some of which are no doubt very loyal and sincere Americans, but other elements of which are not only associated with what I call the underground Reich, but are frankly cynical and more allied with certain profit-making interests or simply bureaucratic inertia under the circumstances, and hence some of the conflicts that exist. I believe that what I call the underground Reich has been deliberately exploiting some of these conflicts and has in fact infiltrated CIA. The late Paul Manning, whose work I've used many times, was of the opinion that the Bormann organization, the underground Reich, had infiltrated the CIA and that the CIA did not know this, and I think his insights are worth bearing in mind in this context. Now, in the context also of the embassy attacks in August of 1998, which you just heard described, and some of the conflicts that occurred between elements of CIA and elements of FBI over the allegiance between elements of CIA and some of the Islamists, such as Osama bin Laden, we're going to review an article that we looked at in, for the record, 338. And if people will think that my concept of the destabilization of the FBI is so much hot air, well, listen to the following. This is excerpted from For the Record program number 338, recorded on December 2nd of the year 2001. As I stated in a number of broadcasts dealing with September 11th, I believe that the operational milieu that was involved with the attacks on the United States in fact involve elements that have worked ostensibly at least with and for the United States, but that in fact doubled on the United States. A very important and thought-provoking article on just such a U.S. intelligence operative who was involved with Al-Qaeda and, in point of fact, doubling on the United States was carried in the Wall Street Journal of Monday, November 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Peter Waldman, Jerry F. Seib, Jerry Markin, and Christopher Cooper, again from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, 11/26/2001. It's headlined, "The Infiltrator, Ali Mohammed Served in the U.S. Army and Bin Laden's Circle." Subtitle, "Lapses in Handling Sergeant Mirror Larger Failings in FBI's Terror Policy." The first clue, the article reads in part as follows. The first clue came back in 1989 outside New York City. There, within view of a secret Federal Bureau of Investigation surveillance camera, stood five Arab men taking target practice at a rifle range. At the time, the FBI wrote them off as harmless zealots, fired up to help the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet puppet government in Afghanistan. What the FBI didn't know was that the young Arabs had a special coach, a U.S. Army sergeant from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, named Ali Mohammed, who had been giving them paramilitary training in a nearby New Jersey apartment. And one other thing the agents didn't know until much later, Mr. Mohammed was a longtime member of a radical Islamic militant group banned in Egypt for assassinating President Anwar Sadat. In retrospect, it is now clear that the FBI had stumbled onto a deadly serious terrorist organization on U.S. soil, one that would eventually be absorbed by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. All five of the target shooters were later convicted on conspiracy charges related to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and its aftermath. And the mysterious Mr. Mohammed would appear over and over again, zealot-like, as Al-Qaeda grew into a genuine threat to American national security. The Sergeant Saga, like the evolution of the broader terrorist threat to America, is the story of intermittent successes, missed clues, and bungled opportunities. The FBI used Mr. Mohammed as an informant at times, extracting from him its first known comprehensive briefing on Al-Qaeda all the way back in 1993. And again, I believe that the September 11th attacks is not an event to be oversimplified. There are elements of U.S. intelligence that were genuinely working against Al-Qaeda, but as the late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the FBI's investigation into Al-Qaeda, concluded before he was killed in those attacks, In fact, the investigation was being frustrated by American corporate ties to Saudi Arabia and oil, and that, in fact, Saudi Arabia was deeply involved in bankrolling Islamic fundamentalism. And I believe that behind that, in turn, and cooperating with that, is what I call the Underground Reich. More about that later. Skipping down in the article, in 1986, after talking about Mr. Muhammad's background with the Egyptian Army Special Forces, in 1986, Mr. Muhammad parlayed his old U.S. Army ties into a spot as an Army supply sergeant and occasional lecturer on Mideast culture at the U.S. Army's Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, a place where he'd studied earlier as an Egyptian officer. His role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic, and moving to an inside page, His role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic world. Little is publicly known about his stint there, which lasted until 1989. An Army spokesman declined to comment, and people who knew him there weren't given permission to speak. His new friends back home in California took for granted that Mr. Muhammad was helping the Central Intelligence Agency in its proxy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. At the time, the anti-Soviet jihad was a worldwide cause among Muslims. Quote, everyone in the community knew he was working as a liaison between the CIA and the Afghan cause, and everyone was sympathetic, unquote, says Ali Zaki, a San Jose, California obstetrician who was close to Mr. Muhammad and his American wife, a medical technician named Linda Sanchez. The CIA declines to comment. And as I've indicated in many of the broadcasts, I believe that the milieu that was used against the Soviets in Afghanistan, including the Grand Mufti-founded World Muslim Congress, was equally opposed to the United States, and then, in combination with the Underground Reich, doubled on the United States. Skipping down again, talking about FBI surveillance of Mr. Nasser, a member of this Islamic terrorist network in the New York area. Mr. Nasser assassinated the American rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Koch party in Israel, a Zionist extremist party in Israel. Continuing and skipping down, had officials looked more closely, they would have found an early and startling chain of relationships. Mr. Nasser was part of a local group inspired by Sheikh Omar Rahman and was determined to wage jihad against the U.S. The group was closely connected to the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn, an office that originally was set up to help the anti-Soviet Mujahideen, but was turning into an Al-Qaeda front. And they would have found that Mr. Muhammad was part of the group. Instead, Mr. Muhammad was free to begin his odyssey into the heart of Al-Qaeda. In 1991, he told a New York federal court years later, a request came into the Brooklyn Al-Kifa office. Could he travel to Sudan to help Mr. Bin Laden set up his base of operations there? He went. A year later, he was off to Afghanistan to help train Al-Qaeda operatives in intelligence, military, and explosive methods. Then, a new and much more frightening terror strike finally prompted investigators to dive back into Mr. Nasser's boxes of information. At 12:17 p.m. on February 26, 1993, a truck bomb exploded on the B-2 level of the World Trade Center parking garage. New York's tallest buildings had been hit for the first time, and six people died. A handful of men were arrested and ultimately convicted in the bombing. Along the way, investigators discovered that some of the plotters had a relationship with Mr. Nasser, and they went back to look at his personal possessions. There, they finally saw the link to Mr. Muhammad, and they began to see they were dealing with a network of would-be terrorists, all seemingly inspired by Sheikh Omar, not a couple of stray car bombers. And as federal investigators were about to discover, they were terrorists intent on striking again. In May 1993, 3 months after the bombing, Sheikh Omar was speaking with one of his disciples at his Jersey City, New Jersey apartment when the man asked whether it would be acceptable in Islam to bomb the FBI's Manhattan headquarters. Now listen to the following. This from an FBI wiretap transcript. Quote, slow down. Slow down a little bit, the Sheikh cautioned, whispering for fear the FBI was bugging his apartment, which it was. Quote, The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, unquote. It was never made clear in later court testimony which assassination the Sheik was talking about. This, of course, is very thought-provoking indeed. The context is not altogether clear. I would note that the official assassin of Robert F. Kennedy was a Palestinian Arab, Saran Saran, and I would also note that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the various assassinations that we had in the 60s, both Kennedy's and Martin Luther King. One of the names connected with a drug smuggling and intelligence ring involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King and allegedly the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. One of the names involved with that was a fellow named Fuad Habash, who was the brother of George Habash, one of the founders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the Palestinian terrorist organizations, connected with the underground Reich and with the fascist Third Position, opposed to both the former Soviet Union and the United States. And again, it's my belief that the executive authority in the assassinations was in fact what I call the underground Reich. Note also that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing and the second attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th, and that in turn those crimes are connected with the AMIA bombing, or at least there are evidentiary tributaries connecting them with the AMIA bombing in Argentina. More about that later. Skipping down again, speaking of the World Trade Center bombers from 1993, the bomber's paramilitary trainer, Mr. Muhammad, was highly educated, having earned two bachelor's degrees and a master's degree at the University of Alexandria in Egypt. Ramzi Youssef, the calculating mastermind of the bombing, was found in Pakistan in a house paid for by the Bin Laden Network. It turned out that he was closely associated with a Saudi Arabian businessman named Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, who happens to be Mr. Bin Laden's brother-in-law. Skipping it down again. The FBI located Mr. Mohammed near San Francisco in 1993, where he volunteered the earliest insider description of al-Qaeda that is publicly known. In his chat with the FBI, court documents in the embassy bombings case show Mr. Muhammad said Mr. Bin Laden was running a group called al-Qaeda, quote, and was building an army, unquote, that might be used to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. He also told the Bureau he had trained terrorists at Mr. Bin Laden's military camps in Sudan and Afghanistan. Yet even though that interview occurred after the World Trade Center blast and after Mr. Muhammad's U.S. training manuals had already been found in Mr. Nasser's possession, Mr. Muhammad was let go without further investigation. Skipping down again. Soon enough, Mr. Muhammad skipped off to Africa on what turned out to be a deadly Bin Laden mission. As he later admitted in court documents, Mr. Bin Laden asked him in 1993 to go to Africa to conduct surveillance of American, British, French, and Israeli targets in Nairobi. I took pictures, drew diagrams, and wrote a report, he testified. He took his research to Sudan, where Mr. Bin Laden then had his headquarters. The terrorist leader, quote, looked at the picture of the American embassy and pointed to where a truck could go as a suicide bomber, unquote, Mr. Muhammad said. A plot to blow up American embassies in Africa, which would mark a turn by al-Qaeda to far more sophisticated operations, was well underway. By 1993, al-Qaeda had established a cell of operations in Kenya. Much as the September 11th hijackers moved in and out of the U.S. for a couple of years, the embassy bombers moved in and out in waves, some conducting surveillance of the embassy, others making preliminary targeting decisions, and still others bringing in supplies to prepare for the attack. The same African cell planned the attack on the U.S. embassy in Tanzania. Even as those plots were falling into place, the FBI was continuing to talk to Mr. Muhammad, never apparently getting a full picture. When prosecutors in the Trade Center conspiracy trial wanted to speak with him, agents working through an intermediary tracked him to a safe house in Nairobi. He told authorities that he had taken a job in the scuba diving business, failing to mention his involvement in the surveillance of al-Qaeda targets. 2 years later, at an interview in October of 1997, he gave agents a detailed account of how he trained Mr. Bin Laden's bodyguards and how al-Qaeda operatives in Somalia helped attack U.S. troops in the early 1990s, causing American deaths, according to court papers. He said he had trained people in, quote, war zones, and war zones can be anywhere, unquote. He also told the FBI that one did not need a fatwa or a ruling from an Islamic religious leader to, quote, to go against the U.S., since it was, quote, obvious, unquote, that the U.S. was the enemy, unquote, court papers say. Still, the U.S. investigators didn't get wind of the African embassy plot, despite Mr. Mohammed's role in it. Finally, in nearly simultaneous attacks on August 7, 1998, the terrorists exploded truck bombs at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Skipping down again, also found were instructions on where to plant bombs to blow up buildings and how to encode messages for secrecy that visit Mr. Mohammed's home in Sacramento. A week later, prosecutors subpoenaed Mr. Mohammed to testify before a federal grand jury investigating Al-Qaeda in New York. Afterward, he was taken into custody. Quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there, beginning again, quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there as a tourist, said Egypt's Mr. Nabil Sharif, a former intelligence officer and a university professor. Again, quoting, if the CIA hadn't caught on to him, it should be dissolved and its budget used for something worthwhile, unquote. Again, the possibility of a fifth column is one to be very seriously considered here.
And we're going to move away from, for the record, program number 338. Again, bear in mind the concept of a fifth column. Bear in mind also the concept of just as I spoke of the Galen Organization as a Trojan horse in the long archive show, for the record, 337. So, too, consider the Islamic fundamentalist forces as basically something very similar, sort of a Trojan horse operating within U.S. intelligence, ostensibly not only for anti-communist purposes, but also for purposes of ultimately destroying the United States in conjunction with, to a certain extent, the underground Reich. I've alluded to other broadcasts that I've made over the years. Those are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can visit their website, Real Audio Equipped website, at www.spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record program number 349 on the Spitfire website within a few days of the broadcast. There are also links to two websites in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and in those descriptions to two websites maintained by WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. One of them has programs streaming. That is WFMU.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. There was a longer URL with For the Record programs available for download only. Sister station WFMU has virtually the entire For the Record series on Real Audio. Now, hang on to your hats because many of the articles that I talk about in this side, many of the items of information, will be reviewed from previous broadcasts, so I'm not going to take a lot of time to provide interpolative discussion. Again, think Machiavelli, think Sun Tzu, think about the concept of the Trojan horse, and also think about past alliances as well, such as the Hitler-Stalin Pact, in which Nazi Germany turned on its ally. Think about the attack on Pearl Harbor, which came relatively unexpectedly. And think also about subversion from within. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that we examined in For the Record program number 341. I suspect that this item, which we looked at in 341, may very well be connected to an article from August of 2001, in turn detailing an occurrence in the summer of 2000. We looked at that in For the Record program number 322. San Jose Mercury of Sunday, December 9th, 2001, has an AP story by Pat Milton headlined, Atta was in New York as early as June of 2000, speaking about Mohammed Atta. Mohammed Atta, apparent ringleader of the September 11th terrorist hijackings, rented rooms in New York City in the spring of 2000 with another hijacker, a federal investigator said, skipping down. Atta's trail in Brooklyn began with a parking ticket issued to a rental car he was driving, said a senior Justice Department official who also spoke on condition of anonymity. And skipping down yet again, Atta, an Egyptian with ties to Islamic militants in Germany, flew to Newark, New Jersey on June 2nd of 2000 from Prague in the Czech Republic, authorities there have said. The trip is his earliest confirmed visit to the United States. June of 2000, Mohammed Atta has a parking ticket in Brooklyn. Now, in that context, consider the following. We looked at this in For the Record program number 322, recorded on August 26th of 2001. That, of course, was a couple of weeks before the attacks occurred. This is an article that was originally published in the New York Times and republished that same day in the San Francisco Chronicle of August 19th of 2001. The article is by David Johnston. The Chronicle headlined the article, FBI Terror Expert Lost Track of Top Secret Plans, subtitled Stolen Briefcase Held Report on New York Operations. Bear in mind that this took place in the summer of 2000, shortly after Atta got his parking ticket, and this was discussed a couple of weeks before the attacks occurred. It reads in part, the FBI has begun an internal investigation into one of its senior-most counterterrorism officials who lost track of a briefcase containing highly classified information last year, again, summer of 2000. The briefcase contained a number of sensitive documents, including a report outlining virtually every national security operation in New York, government officials said. The official, John O'Neill, 49, is the special agent in charge of national security in the FBI's New York office. The job is among the most powerful in the FBI, and although O'Neill is not widely known, he has overseen cases like the terrorist bombing of the Navy destroyer Cole in Yemen last year and the bombings of American embassies in East Africa in 1998. The role of Ali Mohammed, we looked at in those bombings, we looked at in the last side of the program, that in turn a review from For the Record program number 338. Bear in mind the conflict between FBI and elements of CIA over the sponsorship of Islamism and bin Laden that we looked at in the beginning, or at side one of this program, skipping down, about the briefcase that was stolen from O'Neill. Officials identified one document of the briefcase as a draft of the annual field office report for national security operations in New York. The closely guarded report contained a description of every counter-espionage and counter-terrorism program in New York and detailed the manpower for each operation. Last sentence again. The closely guarded report contained a description of every counter-espionage and counter-terrorism program in New York and detailed the manpower for each operation. Skipping down again. O'Neill immediately reported the incident to his superiors, but after the Tampa, Florida authorities recovered the briefcase, it was taken from him and the documents inside it were fingerprinted to determine whether anyone had touched the briefcase and whether the documents were handled by a foreign intelligence service. Skipping down. O'Neill started as an entry-level clerk at the Bureau and has been an agent for more than 25 years. Throughout his career, associates said, O'Neill had been regarded as a dedicated, relentless, and hard-charging investigator who was one of the FBI's brightest stars. But associates said he sometimes chafed at the restrictive rules at the Bureau and his single-mindedness had sometimes irritated colleagues in the Bureau, at the CIA, and at the State Department. O'Neill's aggressiveness had led to serious frictions in the Cole bombing case, for example. This year, the U.S. ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, blocked O'Neill from returning to Yemen to oversee the FBI investigation of the bombing of the Cole. O'Neill had led the initial team of agents in Yemen after the bombing last fall, but ran afoul of Bodine over what she considered his heavy-handed style, State Department officials said. Bear in mind that as we looked at in For the Record program number 326, two of the suspects in connection with September 11th were also suspects on the list of suspects in connection with the Cole bombing. John O'Neill in charge of the investigation into bin Laden. John O'Neill also, as we have seen in For the Record 326 and in other broadcasts, and we're going to review some aspects of those broadcasts, O'Neill resigned the FBI over his frustration with what he viewed as official interdiction and obstruction of his investigation due to the Saudi participation and the sponsorship of bin Laden and American oil and corporate connections to American petroleum industry and corporate connections to Saudi Arabia and consequently interfering elements in the bin Laden investigation. Bearing in mind Atta's arrest in Brooklyn in June of 2000 and the theft of O'Neill's briefcase that summer detailing every counterterrorist and counterintelligence operation in New York, including manpower allocations, I wonder whether that was perhaps because of the parking ticket that Atta had received, whether perhaps it was to determine whether the operation had been compromised. And again, bear in mind that the two suspects in connection with September 11th were also on the list of suspects in connection with the Cole bombing that John O'Neill had been investigating. Reviewing an article that we looked at in For the Record program number 337, bearing in mind my ruminations in For the Record program 310, 325, and 326, among others, about a destabilization of the FBI, this article is from the New York Times of Monday, November 12th of 2001, well after those broadcasts were aired. It's by Ethan Bronner, and it's titled, Oil Diplomacy Muddled U.S. Pursuit of Bin Laden, New Book Contends. And this would tend to reinforce my analysis presented in some of those broadcasts, the broadcast that I just enumerated. The article reads in part, a former FBI anti-terror official who was killed at the World Trade Center on September 11th complained bitterly last summer that the United States was unwilling to confront Saudi Arabia over Osama bin Laden and that oil ruled American foreign policy, according to a new book published in France. The former official, John P. O'Neill, was the director of anti-terrorism for the FBI's New York office when he resigned in August to become chief of security for the Twin Towers. Quote, all the answers, everything needed to dismantle Osama bin Laden's organization can be found in Saudi Arabia, unquote. Mr. O'Neill is quoted as saying in the new book, Bin Laden la vérité interdite, Bin Laden the forbidden truth, which argues that Saudi support for Mr. bin Laden has been extensive. One of the book's co-authors, Jean-Charles Brizal, a security expert who has spent several years examining Mr. bin Laden's financial empire, says in the book that he met with Mr. O'Neill in June and July. Mr. O'Neill is quoted as lamenting, quote, the inability of American officials to get anything at all from King Fahd, the ailing Saudi ruler. He explains the failure in one word, oil. In telephone interviews and email exchanges, Mr. Brizal elaborated on the book released this week by French publishing house De Noël. He said he first met Mr. O'Neill in June in Paris, where the two had dinner with a group of French anti-terror officials. Mr. Brizal had written a book for the French intelligence services on the finances of Mr. bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization, and he gave Mr. O'Neill a copy. In late July, he said, they met alone in New York for drinks and dinner, and Mr. O'Neill complained that the FBI was not free to act in international terror investigations because the State Department kept interfering. Mr. O'Neill, who had worked on investigations of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and on the attacks on two American embassies in Africa in 1998, also suggested that he would soon move to the private sector, Mr. Brizal said. Mr. Brizal said his conversations with Mr. O'Neill were not interviews. He is publicizing Mr. O'Neill's opinions as, quote, a tribute, unquote, to a man he admired. John O'Neill did indeed resign from the FBI over his frustration with what he saw as official interdiction of his investigation of the bin Laden affair. He was hired as director of security for the World Trade Center in August of 2001 and was killed in the attacks. Bear in mind that also in August of 2001, hours before they were scheduled to begin, as we looked at in For the Record 337, Saudi Arabia canceled its annual military maneuvers with the United States for reasons as yet unexplained. The week before the September 11th attacks, Prince Turki, who for 20-plus years had been the director of Saudi intelligence, was replaced. And it was Prince Turki, according to many sources, that was running Osama bin Laden and who had, in turn, been interfacing and liaising directly with the petroleum and Bush-related factions of U.S. intelligence. And remember that on September 11th also, the Carlyle Group, one of the business ventures that marries the petrodollar interests of the bin Mahfouz and bin Laden families with those of the Bush family, the Carlyle Group is having its annual investor conference at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on September 11th, and James Baker, the elder George Bush's Secretary of State, and members of the bin Laden family, along with Frank Carlucci, watched as the World Trade Center towers collapsed. Their first IPO took place less than a month later, with their defense interests having significantly appreciated in value. The day after September 11th, 12 members of the bin Laden family, whose geographical base in the United States is Boston, from which both planes that crashed into the World Trade Center towers took off, the day after September 11th, members of the bin Laden family were flown out of the United States before they could be interviewed by the FBI, this in a private jet hired by Prince Turki. Long story made short, On September 12th, the only civilians who were able to fly in the United States were apparently members of the Bin Laden family. And again, note that John O'Neill charged that Saudi Arabia, petroleum, and American corporate interests the same had frustrated his investigation because of, and that profound Saudi support for Bin Laden underlay that frustration. We're going to review another element that we looked at in For the Record program number 337. This also about the book Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite. This is from an article by Julio Goday in Paris. It's dated November 15th of 2001 by the Interpress Service. U.S. policy towards Taliban influenced by oil. And this is from the Interpress Service. And there's a link to their website in the description for the Record 337. Skipping down about the Bin Laden La Vérité Interdite book, the two authors claim that the U.S. government's main objective in Afghanistan was to consolidate the position of the Taliban regime to obtain access to the oil and gas reserves in Central Asia. They affirm that until August, the U.S. government saw the Taliban regime, quote, as a source of stability in Central Asia that would enable the construction of an oil pipeline across Central Asia from the rich oil fields in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan, through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. Until now, says the book, the oil and gas reserves of Central Asia have been controlled by Russia. The Bush government wanted to change all that. Unquote. And skipping down, the last meeting between the U.S. and Taliban representatives took place in August, 5 weeks before the attacks on New York and Washington, the analysts maintain. On that occasion, Christina Rocha, in charge of Central Asian affairs for the U.S. government, met the Taliban ambassador to Pakistan in Islamabad. And again, bear in mind that UNICAL is heavily invested in by the elder George Bush. We're going to take a look now at an article that's going to deal with some of the reorganization of the FBI. Now, we're going to review in a second who was in charge of the FBI, having been appointed in July of 2000, shortly before John O'Neill resigned from the FBI. He was hired as director of security for the World Trade Center and then killed in the attacks. San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 4th of 2001, has the following article. It's a New York Times story. FBI Director Announces Reorganization of Bureau. FBI Director Robert Mueller announced yesterday that he is reorganizing the Bureau in an attempt to address a series of embarrassing administrative lapses and strengthen the agency's ability to deter terrorist attacks. And it's interesting that Mueller was interested in reorganizing the Bureau because, indeed, Mueller himself has a background which would suggest that perhaps his objectivity in connection with the investigation would be to a certain extent compromised by previous investigations, in particular that of the BCCI. He was in charge of the first Bush administration's investigation into the BCCI for the Justice Department. What we're going to do now is to review a section from For the Record program number 310 from July of 2001. And this, bear in mind, was a couple of months, roughly, before the September 11th attacks. And we're going to listen to some of the information about the background of Robert Mueller, who assumed directorship of the Bureau less than 2 weeks before the attacks. Recently, the FBI, which has been under fire in a number of different contexts, has undergone a change of leadership. Louis Freeh, the director of the FBI, stepped down, and he has now been replaced, at least assuming that Robert Mueller's his nomination is confirmed, which in all likelihood it will be. Robert Mueller actually pronounces his name Mueller. Last name is spelled M-U-E-L-L-E-R. Mueller himself is an interesting fellow, and as head of the criminal investigation section of the Department of Justice under George I, he oversaw some very interesting cases which have connections to the Iran-Contra scandal. Oh, by the way, Rags to Riches is For the Record program number 277. I knew the number would come to me. The following is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, July 6th of the year 2001. This is a Chronicle story by Zachary Coyle, C-O-I-L-E, and Bob Egelko, or Egelko, E-G-E-L-K-O. Its headline, SF Prosecutor Mueller Picked to Lead FBI and Mend Its Image. And in a sidebar to this article, there's discussion of some of the top cases that Mueller oversaw. It reads, while he was head of the Justice Department's criminal division, Robert S. Mueller III oversaw several high-profile matters.
The prosecution of Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega on drug charges, the inquiry into the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and the BCCI investigation, a huge international fraud case. Three of these, the three that I just named, impinge directly not only on the Iran-Contra scandal, but also on the overlapping Iraqgate scandal. And one of the things that's significant about these cases is that had they been investigated to the full, to the extent that they might have, these almost certainly would have brought down George Bush, certainly led to his impeachment, if not his ultimate conviction on criminal charges. The lead paragraph of this story, by the way, reads, President Bush tapped Robert S. Mueller III, the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, as the new director of the FBI yesterday, seeking a no-nonsense manager to repair the image of an agency accused of botching several recent high-profile cases. We're going to chat about BCCI in a minute. More about the BCCI case, this from an article in the Chronicle the preceding day. This is from Tuesday, actually 2 days early. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, July 3rd of the year 2001. This is an article by Stacy Finz, F-I-N-Z, of the Chronicle. It's headlined, In the Running for FBI Director, subtitled, Bush Considers Low-Key SF Federal Prosecutor for Job. And of the BCCI investigation, by the way, the BCCI was called the Bank of Credit, was the abbreviation for an institution called the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. This was nicknamed the Bank for Crooks and Crooks and something else. Anyway, WAGS gave it a different name. BCCI was heavily involved not only with some of the funding of the Iran-Contra scandal, but also served as a vehicle for the repository of drug money and also for the funds used by various terrorist groups as well. Again, it was deeply involved, and the BCCI was deeply involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. Oliver North used an account with BCCI for many of his machinations. And BCCI is an institution with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. More about BCCI in a minute. Skipping down in this story, from Boston, Mueller went to Washington, D.C., where he served as the head of the Justice Department's criminal division in George Bush's administration. It was there that he oversaw the prosecutions of Noriega and headed up investigation of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International scandal, a huge fraud case in which people throughout the Third World lost their life savings. By the time the BCCI probe picked up steam, several Washington power brokers were implicated, and allegations surfaced that the Justice Department was balking at the investigation because of alleged CIA links. By the way, those alleged CIA links are they're a matter of public record. Continuing, then Representative Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, fired off a report critical of the Justice Department's treatment of the case, saying the failure to pursue wrongdoing might be because too many prominent politicians had connections to BCCI. Quote, there is possibly a cover-up or a conspiracy, unquote, Schumer, now a U.S. senator, said in 1991. Again quoting, there is also a 50% chance that it was just ineptitude, a failure to go after white-collar crime. Well, I suspect that there was a whole lot more to it than that. Again, BCCI was centrally involved in the Iran-Contra affair. It was one of the many connections that would have undoubtedly led back to the elder George Bush, who was not only in the loop, but was the main orchestrator of the Iran-Contra affair, the vehicle for realizing the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate machinations were the intergovernmental agency networks that were put together pursuant to the president's task force on combat, the vice president's task force on combating terrorism that was headed up by George Bush, and the networks that were created out of the recommendations that that task force put together were utilized by George Bush as sort of his own private intelligence service. They were the main vehicle for the realizing of both the Iran-Contra machinations and the Iraqgate machinations, and had the BCCI affair been properly investigated, it would have gone back to the elder George Bush. It also, as we're going to talk about in a minute, might have very well gone forward and tarred the current George Bush, George II, with the very same brush. That, again, excerpted from For the Record program number 310, broadcast originally in July of 2001. What we're going to look at now is an article that we looked at in For the Record program number 336. Research credit on this to a member of the listening audience who got this for us from the Indianapolis Star. Specifically, this is from the Indianapolis Star of November 3rd of 2001. This can be found on their website at www.indystar.com, I-N-D-Y-S-T-A-R.com. And bear in mind, too, what I've talked about in connection with the destabilization of the FBI. This is an article by James Patterson. It's headlined, Justice Department Won't Let Agent Testify. While Terry Nichols, already convicted on federal charges in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, returned to court Monday to face the state's case against him, the government was squirming to squelch evidence that Nichols and Timothy McVeigh did not act by themselves. Nichols' attorneys asked Judge Ray Dean Linder if former FBI agent Dan Vogel could testify that he had received 22 affidavits from Oklahomans who had seen McVeigh in the company of Middle Eastern men in the months, weeks, and days leading up to the bombing and on the day of the attack. Nichols' attorney, Barbara Bergman, said Agent Vogel, who has since retired, also wanted to testify that he had sent the 22 affidavits he got from former TV investigative reporter Jaina Davis to FBI agent Henry C. Gibbons. But the FBI has not shared those affidavits with anyone, and he may have destroyed them. On Monday, Judge Linda ruled that Vogel could not testify for Nichols regarding the affidavits because the Justice Department doesn't want the former FBI agent to be heard. Quote, the ruling was that he, Linder, would not permit him, Agent Vogel, to testify because the Department of Justice had taken the position that it would not authorize his testimony, Bergman said Thursday. Is our own Justice Department so terrified of the truth that it won't let a retired FBI agent testify about affidavits regarding the Oklahoma City bombing? Can the government legally do this? It can try, Bergman says, bearing in mind that as we looked at in For the Record program number 330, an agent, a witness, who was not permitted to testify in the trial of Timothy McVeigh, testified that Terry Nichols and Ramzi Youssef, another Arab-Afghan veteran of the Afghan War and involved with not only the Al-Qaeda milieu, but also with the first World Trade Center attack, this witness, Edwin Angeles, was prepared to testify that Ramzi Youssef and Terry Nichols were apparently together at a meeting in the Philippines. Bear in mind the item from Dollars for Terror that we looked at in the first half of the program, which discussed a Philippine connection to Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law and the fact that an element of U.S. intelligence was responsible for his entry into the United States. And again, we've spoken about some of the Middle Eastern terrorist and Islamic fundamentalist liaisons with Nazi, fascist, and white supremacist terrorist elements in the United States. It is that kind of connection that, in one sense, could be seen to be embodied in the Nazi inclinations and sympathies of the American Taliban, Hyrum Torres, that we looked at the beginning of this broadcast. Reviewing yet another element that we've looked at in past programs, this from the L.A. Times of Tuesday, November 6th of 2001. This was discussed originally in For the Record program 341. Bearing in mind a number of FBI agents who had taken affidavits showing that Timothy McVeigh had apparently been seen in the company of Middle Eastern men. Bear in mind also that McVeigh was dispatched in June of 2001 and the documents had turned up concerning the investigation shortly before that. That in turn helped to discredit the FBI. One wonders if perhaps a deliberate discreditation and subversion of the federal police force, which for all of its shortcomings is obviously absolutely essential to American national security, and its integrity is obviously absolutely essential to a prevention of further terrorist attacks in the United States, again bearing in mind the concept of the FBI as being destabilized by a fascist slash terrorist connected fifth column within U.S. intelligence and connected to what I call the Underground Reich. L.A. Times 11-6-2001 has the following article by Eric Lichtblau, headlined, FBI turns down hundreds of ex-agents offering help. Dateline Washington, it reads in part as follows. Despite an enormous drain on its manpower, the FBI is turning down help in its dual terrorism and anthrax investigations from some of its most experienced supporters, former agents. As many as 350 former FBI special agents have expressed interest in coming back to work for the Bureau to assist in the wide-ranging investigations into the September 11 terrorist attacks and the anthrax mailing, skipping down. The response we got was, thanks but no thanks, said retired FBI agent Larry C. Upchurch, a 28-year veteran who was pushing the FBI to reconsider its position. Quote, I'm a little bit perplexed. I don't want to carry a gun or a badge. I just want the help. Unquote. And again, I would suggest, as crazy as this will seem to some people, that the FBI may very well be being destabilized itself as part of a destabilization and subversion of the United States. Again, one consider the concept of the Pearl Harbor attack meeting the Reichstag fire that I looked at earlier. And specifically, we examined in 344, 5, and 6. Consider the following as well. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of Saturday, October 6th of 2001. This is a New York Times story by David Johnston and Philip Sheenan, or Shannon, S-H-E-N-O-N, at Dateline, Washington, and headlined, In August, FBI held off on probe of suspicious man. This is about Zacharias Moussaoui, who, by the way, is being represented in France by Isabelle Coutant-Père, who in turn is going to marry Carlos the Jackal, and was a protege of Jacques Vergès, the lawyer for, among others, Carlos the Jackal and also Klaus Barbie, and a protege of François Janoux, an intimate of, among others, Adolf Hitler and the heir to the literary works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. We've looked at that in numerous broadcasts, including, for the record, 333, 340, and 344. This article is about Zacharias Moussaoui, and it reads in part, The FBI held back its agents last August from opening a criminal investigation of a man who investigators now suspect was meant to be the 20th hijacker in the September 11th attacks, a senior Justice Department official said Friday. Skipping down. Of Moussaoui, senior officials at FBI headquarters rejected requests from agents in Minneapolis for a wider investigation on two occasions, even after a French intelligence agency warned the Bureau in a classified two-page cable August 27th that Moussaoui had, quote, Islamic extremist views, unquote. And this basically concerns attempts by FBI agents to get a warrant under the auspices of something called the FISA. They were unable to do this, and this in turn is leading to proposals for a widening of FISA powers. Those might very well be warranted in order to help counterterrorism, but one wonders about possible subversion of civil liberties in that context. And bear in mind also that John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, is someone who has, shall we say, a less than exciting record, as we looked at in For the Record 271 and also in For the Record program number 339. John Ashcroft, before becoming the director of the FBI, or the Attorney General, excuse me, John Ashcroft had been involved with attempting to aid a Dr. Sell, who, among other things, was plotting to murder an FBI agent who had effected Dr. Sell's arrest in connection with a fraud case. This concludes For the Record program number 348, Side 2, the destabilization of the FBI, being recorded on February 25th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.